We always have conversations about what's going on in the market. If you're not, that's kind of irresponsible in my point of view. But we've always had a dictum that our strategy dictates the fund size, and fund size does not dictate strategy. And every single GP will repeat those exact words. And so for us, it's always like, okay, we're trying to lead rounds that are B's and C's, and in the occasional D, and even sometimes an A, but how big are those rounds? If we want to write the lead check, how big is that lead check for the premium companies on average? And we want to write 30 or 40 of those checks per fund over 3 years. That tells you our fund size.
I'm struggling with a number of managers where there is no succession plan. They're well into, this is not like funds two or three. Succession plans are incredibly important, especially for long enduring, you know, kind of funds that we hope to invest with into the future.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Squarespace. Turn your idea into a new website. Go to squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use offer code TWIST to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Google for Startups. Accelerate your startup journey with the Google for Startups Cloud Program. Get up to 200K in Google Cloud credits or up to 350K for AI startups, plus training and guidance. Apply at startups.google.com/twist. And Brex, the financial stack founders can bank on. Brex knows cash is king for startups, so they built a banking experience that takes every dollar further. Get the business bank account trusted by 1 in 3 U.S. startups at brex.com/twist24.
Welcome back to this week's Liquidity Podcast. With me today, I have Tom Lovero of IVP. Next, we have Dana Johns, head of private equity at the State of New Jersey Division of Investment, which manages a whopping $90 billion. And of course, we have Jason Calacanis from the Launch Fund. I'm your moderator, David Weisbert, co-founder of 10X Capital. Today, we have many interesting topics to discuss. Secondary pricing is giving us hope of a potential recovery in the VC market. VC leverage is at the same time an all-time high against startups. We look at the metrics there. We discuss the NVCA monitor and what it spells for the industry. And finally, there's a new hot sector in the startup ecosystem, and it's not AI. We'll finish with the latest three investments from Tom and Jason. Let's get right to it. Last week, we saw some positive news with some promise of DPI coming back with Sequoia's planned purchase of Stripe. This week, we're seeing another bullish signal. TechCrunch reports that the median price for company secondaries is at a 31% discount, coming up from a 46% discount just 7 months ago. Secondaries market has heated up recently with Industry Ventures' new $1.45 billion fund raised in September. StepStone raising a $3.3 billion secondaries fund to focus just on venture, and Blackstone's rumored secondaries fund that expected to top its previous fund, which was a whopping $23.5 billion. Tom, you spend a lot in the mid-stage and later-stage venture, Series B and Series C. What are you seeing from a valuation standpoint today?
The chart you have of secondaries is, I think, pretty representative of what's happening in primaries as well. Jason, you and I have discussed the Great Extinction event, which if you draw a line on that chart, you know, that was published in January of 23. That was probably around the low point of valuations and liquidity as well, funding. But we've seen a really strong rebound, but in a healthy way. Like, everybody's very cognizant of the public multiples that people are getting now. So I think on average, things are rationalizing. It feels pretty normal to me.
Yeah, I think what's interesting to build on those comments, Tom, is that investors, GPs, have a certain amount of time and bandwidth. And in a cataclysmic event like we witnessed when the market, let's call it what it is, it crashed for private companies, you know, you had to give maybe 80% of your time to your existing portfolio and stabilizing. In some cases, it was 100%. There were some VCs I know, I would forward them an interesting accelerated company that say, J-Cal, not the time, I'm doing triage. And so, this is the finite resource. Capital is not a finite resource. The capital allocator time is very limited. What this represents to me is, well, there's three places you can spend your time. One, your existing portfolio companies. Two, finding new ones. And then there's this third place you could find value, and that's the secondary market. And so for people who are looking for value, a lot of these companies are known entities. They have known management teams. They have functioning boards. And so then there just has to be a clearing price. And so I think we went through a period where there were no bids on these companies. Like even for great ones, you know, Instacart, great product, market cap was obviously out of sync with market realities and then potential IPO. Stripe, same thing, 100 billion, 50 billion. Now it's 75 billion, I think, in the Sequoia secondary that they did recently. So, you know, it's not like these are bargain hunters necessarily. I think these are people looking for value. But even myself, I have to look at my existing portfolio and say, is my next best investment a company that we've already funded or the next new company? And that's great for capital allocators to now be looking at the existing, you know, cohort of companies that raised their Series B, C, D, aren't IPOing necessarily anytime soon, but they're also not, you know, in Techstars or Y Combinator or, you know, on Seed Extension 4. So this is a extremely promising sign. Now, I do wonder about this data, and David, which is, you know, is this a company's clearing market? In other words, there must be a large number of companies that aren't even on these secondary markets because there is nobody buying or selling them. Or I should say nobody buying them. Therefore, there's nobody selling them. There might actually be buyers. So it's a great sign. Combined with last 6 week news, these are two great signs.
Dana, how do you feel about secondaries in the secondary market today?
We're super excited about secondaries, but I'll set some context for why I'm so excited about them and how I'm going to include them in my portfolio. Our private equity portfolio is about $11 billion in NAV. It's largely skewed, it's global, but largely skewed to North America, large buyout. And that's primarily because over time, you know, we invested in buyout managers who are in the middle market who have now just, you know, kind of grown up and are now mega funds. We've had very little venture in the portfolio. The venture that I do have in the portfolio, we were accessing through partners where we have SMAs. We have about 30% of my portfolio is managed by separately managed accounts with different partners. We leverage those partners. Our investment process is fairly challenging. It just takes a long time. And sometimes with venture, the fundraise is 6 months. You know, it takes us sometimes, you know, over a year. The secondary market has primarily been, you know, focused on buyout. And there's been, as you noted, you know, kind of industry ventures and StepStone have the largest secondary focused funds. A lot of these larger funds, you know, haven't really focused on venture. It's just been too hard for them, primarily because, you know, kind of relative to the pricing and trying to price a portfolio, an LP portfolio, venture has always been much lower, 25 to 35%, where buyouts getting, you know, depending on the timing and the quality of the funds, like 80%. So it's just been, you know, challenging for venture. But I do think venture is catching up. I do think because of liquidity needs that LPs need, there are more opportunities for really great portfolios to become available. And for someone like me who's trying to build a venture portfolio where I'm trying to do a couple of things, I'm missing vintage years, I'm missing managers, I'm really excited about, you know, being able to, we just actually today, in building out this secondary program at New Jersey, I always think of things as like three pillars. So we've just approved a buyout, more European focused, but buyout secondaries manager, which does LP and GP led structurings. But anyways, so I could go on about why we're excited. But, you know, we think it's also from the perspective of duration. I would like to, you know, kind of shorten the duration. This is a long, you know, kind of long duration asset class. If I can get in at a point where these assets, these, you know, portfolio companies are mature, not seed, but, you know, kind of more mature, then kind of moving, you know, shortening the duration, mitigating J-curve, and smoothing cash flows.
No one knows your product like you do, but knowing how to build something customers want is only half the battle. You have to sell it to them. And that's where Squarespace comes in. Squarespace is the e-commerce tool that you need. We all know Squarespace builds beautiful websites, right? I say Squarespace, you say, oh, beautiful, stunning website. But did you know Squarespace Payments makes it super simple to earn online, or that Squarespace has the marketing tools you need to reach new customers, and that Squarespace can help you with email, analytics, and even design? Just like you're the best at building your product, Squarespace is the best at websites and e-commerce. There's no doubt. They're the best. They've been at it the longest. They make the best product. They're relentless at listening to their customers and making great features so that your business can grow. So check out squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/twist and they'll give you 10% off your first website or domain purchase. That's squarespace.com/twist. You know what would be really helpful? Go ahead and tweet or put on LinkedIn, thank you to Squarespace for supporting This Week in Startups. If you do that, you know, just like five of you do that, they see it. And they're like, yeah, you know, cool people listen to the pod and we should support that pod. They're the longest running partner we've ever had on This Week in Startups. And for that, I am so grateful.
What is the ideal target for some of these like industrial and everybody? You know, do you know, David, what their or Tom, what their return window is? What are they saying? 5-7 years? What are they saying?
I think it's almost similar to growth equity. They're very tightly banded. I heard a statistic somewhere that there's almost never been a secondary fund that returned less than a 1x or something. It's almost never happened. So it's always within this like 1.5, and then 2.5 is like the absolute best because these assets are already mature. But
what time period are they looking at? Does anybody have insight into that?
I don't know what they have on the cover of their PPM. My sense is it's like 5-7 years is generally what they're targeting on their investments, probably targeting 5 and then something stretch out.
Makes sense. Overall, David, I think pairing this with last week's news about Stripe and Wiz now flip-flopping, we're going to sell, we're going to go public. I mean,
that's a bullish signal, right?
Well, yeah, if there ever was a bullish signal, it would be immediate greed versus long-term greed. You know, I'm always looking for greed in the system. And, you know, it's like Gordon Gekko said, like, you know, it's good. When you see people getting greedy like this, you know what? We could sell it and take the $23 billion right now, or we can IPO into a market that would never value the company at $23 billion like Google would. That tells you something about their long-term hypothesis for that business.
One of the things on secondaries that's interesting is that if you're coming from the outside and looking at venture secondaries, you would think it's kind of this super liquid, super efficient market that people have different views on different assets. There's really two large buyers. One is existing people on the cap table. You might have an IVP on the cap table and someone selling shares. A lot of times the main investors will actually have the right of first refusal, the ROFR on the shares. They'll be able to go that. And of course, the company loves to have existing shareholders buy those shares because they don't have to bring new people on the cap table. They don't have to deal with information leakage. And then you have these other parties with these secondary funds, Industry Ventures, Blackstone, also Lexington has a pretty big sleeve in this. And the reason they're willing and able to get into these opportunities is because they have a really good reputation. So if you're looking at like Wiz, they're raising money and somebody comes to them, they say, I want to get out of my position. Another way to look at that is like, I want to end my relationship with you, Wiz, the company. They don't have a huge incentive to accommodate them for many reasons. Most of the time, they don't want them sharing any information in the market because a lot of times, Jason, you've seen this, like you'll have somebody blast out their information to like 20, 30, 40 buyers, right? Because they're getting out of the position. Yep. They want to maximize their price. Because in the secondary market, you have two main drivers, price and information. For those buyers that have perfect information, oftentimes they're even able to bid higher. So I think that's interesting. And then you've had this new retail class of secondary buyers via platforms like Forge, where you have, it's typically like very late stage companies, pre-IPO companies, they're 2-3 years away from buying. So I think it's an interesting space. It's a space that's largely driven by the ability to transfer shares, but information, and also frankly, regulatory. VC funds like 10X Capital, like IVP, we're not able to hold more than 20%, right, of our AUM in secondary funds, or else you get kind of in this dreaded RIA area where a lot of funds don't want to go, although it's becoming much more acceptable to do that. So there's a lot of interesting things that lead to the kind of these returns in the industry.
It seems like the trend, though, has been in one direction over the past, 19 years, at least that I've been in venture, which is towards more and more liquidity, both on the LP side with secondaries and also on the cap table side of the companies themselves for employees and founders. You know, it's interesting. Like, I don't know where that naturally ends. Like, how liquid do the private markets become 20 years from now? Because there is a pull, and a push between people wanting to be able to sell at any time they want, but also the companies wanting to control information and wanting to control who's on their cap table. But my sense is things are going to still get even more liquid, both for GPs and LPs in the future.
You mentioned retail. I mean, if retail can get access to this asset class in a predictable, trustworthy way, this could get really exciting. And you see that with this. I've been tracking this company. I had the founder on Destiny 100 or something. He basically raised $100 million to buy secondary, and he got himself an allocation at SpaceX and a couple of other things. And he's got this publicly tradable, I guess it's an ETF, where you can buy it. And man, it has been like a meme stock. And so I don't think that that's the ultimate format for doing this. But it does show, like crypto did, that retail wants alpha. They want to swing for the fences. They want access to, really high potential, high risk venture assets. And so, I don't know which administration would be most pro this, but I have a feeling J.D. Vance would very much, with his venture experience, help us push through more fluidity in access to the asset class, which would benefit a lot of emerging managers and create more liquidity.
One thing that's been interesting to see is some of the most progressive thinking companies have instituted these tender processes. SpaceX famously has a tender twice a year where they let all their employees or their current employees sell via a specific price. They control the process. They bring in the buyers and everything. So I think that would be something that would benefit a lot of companies. But you do get in a position where you have NVIDIA. I don't know if you saw today, Jason, something like 73% of NVIDIA shareholders are millionaires and 25% have over 10 or 20 million.
Are you talking about employees?
Employees.
Yeah.
And that becomes a problem because, somebody comes to you and says, I want you to spend all of August in the office, and you look in the bank and you're making 20 million and your salary is $200,000. It becomes a bit of an issue there.
Part of the process, there'll be like Google, and Apple and Microsoft before them. Tom's much older than me. He's much more experienced. I'm joking. It's a little bit older. But that is what creates, the next wave of companies is people who make their $10 or $20 million chip and they got a chip on their shoulder and they want to be the CEO and they think they can do it better or they saw some opportunity. So, it's short-term pain for the company to have to turn over staff, but every time I've seen companies turn over staff, I'd say more times than not, the company is stronger because the company knows what it needs more and there's an infusion of new talent and energy. So high class. There were a lot of Google millionaires also who, started other companies.
I always say there's a reason there's a 4-year vesting schedule at most startups. It's not a number we just picked out of the, out of the sky. Like there's a shelf life for how long or half life for how long people want to be at a startup, and it's usually somewhere between 4 and 8 years. And so that's why we grant equity in those schedules. It's very rare for somebody these days to be at a company for 10 or 20 years. And that's a natural thing. That's okay. Like that, I think as everybody here knows, without the non-compete laws in California and equity vesting that doesn't go on forever, it allows people to jump jobs and take skills with them to the next thing. So
yeah,
I think it's very healthy. Market.
And Tom, you have a lot of CEOs ask you about secondaries, and when is the earliest that is appropriate for a founder to get liquidity via secondary?
Yeah, I think it's all a matter of degrees. It's one thing to take a few $100,000, to make up for the fact that you're barely paying yourself for the last few years, or maybe to buy the first house. It's different if a founder's taking 50 or 100 million off the table. There's no perfect guidelines, but I like to think about it in terms of how stable is the company? How close are they to a liquidity event? How do we think about the other founders, the other employees, and fairness, and trying to be more inclusive there? There was definitely a point, though, in 2020 and 21, where I think founders pushed it a little too far, and VCs were more than happy to oblige. And it feels like that's been dialed back, but we're also not going back to like the early 2000s, where founder secondary was this like super taboo topic that would ruin a company and nobody even wanted to broach. Now it's like, hey man, yeah, you know, San Francisco's expensive. You just had your second kid and you need to move, you know, houses. Like, sure, that makes sense. There's a good reason for that. So I think the world is more rational when it comes to these things.
It's kind of like how LPs think about GPs and GP stakes when a fund is taking on capital, outside capital, and how is that capital being used? Is it being used for growing the firm versus taking money off the table? You know, a little bit different, but you know, it's kind of signals, right? You know, how dedicated are you?
Yeah, I love this pari passu term. Not just how wonderful it sounds rolling off your tongue, but just in the reality of it, you know, we've had many situations with founders and other investors who gets to sell, right? And it does seem profoundly unfair when one group has that option, another group doesn't have that option. And, you know, we've seen that in companies. When this first was bubbling up, Zynga had a bunch of secondary interest and Gary Milner was buying shares and this group was buying shares. And, you know, Mark Pincus was not letting people sell shares. He wanted control of the company and who was on the cap table. It was a very unique moment in time. Evan Williams went a different way with Twitter, where, you know, he let Chris Sacca, Ron Conway, some others, I think, create vehicles to manage that process. And it all kind of got hashed out there, which is, if people have access to the information and they're making a thoughtful decision, and to Tom's point, it's not life-changing FU money, which technically starts, you know, at 20 million. the last thing you want is a founder thinking about planes, you know, at the board meeting and you know, what houses they're going to buy. I've seen it. It's very distracting. Especially for a young founder, you know, it takes 100 million, 200 million off the table. And actually, that's where a lot of times the test comes in. When they do actually make those big sales, that's when you see a founder drop out. And then you see the other founder double down, right? And then that's when the board can make a decision. Hey, this person's checking out. This person's doubling down. Well, then that tells you how compensation should go from that point forward. So it's a good test. And I think this is really going to help us go long in the industry. And the longer we can go in an investment, and the more independent it can be, the greater the chances of an IPO, the greater chances of a sustainable company that doesn't get bought by Microsoft, Google, and Apple, and Meta. And that's actually healthier for the ecosystem as well. It'd be really nice if, you know, this gang of seven was a gang of 70 or 17 at least, and we didn't have, you know, Amazon, Apple, and Google ruling the roost, as it were.
All right, founders. One of the things you always ask me for is, hey, will you invest in my company? And sometimes you want some advice, I know. And the other thing I get constantly asked about is, hey, how do I get into Google for Startups Cloud Program? You know, the one where you get all that technical training, business guidance, and a huge number of credits. That's right, $200,000 in Google Cloud credits, or $350,000 if you're building an AI startup. This is really important for startups because you want to build something super innovative, but you may not have the capital yet, and Google wants to be there to support you. Plus, you get Google Workspace perks, Google Domains, all that other great stuff. Whether or not you've raised capital or you're just getting started, Google for Startups Cloud Program can help you accelerate your startup. 90% of Gen AI unicorns choose Google Cloud. So if you want to get in on these credits, please do it quickly. Find out everything that you get inside of Google Startup Cloud Program. Visit startups.google.com/twist. That's right, startups.google.com/twist to learn more and get your startup to the next level.
Next up, the second quarter NVCA monitor is out, and there are a lot of great nuggets in the report. One gauge of the market is the Investor Startup Index, which shows that VCs are near all-time high as it relates to leverage against startups, up from a low in Q4 2021 when startups had leverage on VCs, as Tom mentioned earlier. Not all metrics in the report were positive, however. Price to sales, the technical term for price to revenue for VC companies going public, was down to 4.9x from 12.6x at the height of COVID, signaling that now may still not be the best time to go public. Dana, you got a chance to read through the report. What are some of your takeaways?
I know this sounds kind of bizarre, but as a long-term investor, I think about macro trends and I think in decades. I don't think quarter to quarter. I know. I read the quarterly reports. I do. It's thinking about, you know, kind of a private market investor versus a public equity investor, and a private market investor thinking about, I'm putting capital on the ground today, and I'm thinking that it gets invested over the next 3 to 5 years. I don't have a crystal ball, so I don't know what 5 years, 10 years is going to look like. But I invest with parameters, which are basically, you know, kind of return. What's the return target? Is this manager going to meet those? Have they met that? Have they met that target? We have like 52 GP relationships, over 100 funds, definitely over 100 funds. So as we're managing, I'm actually like kind of head down into what's happening in the portfolio. And then I like stick my head up, you know, kind of quarter to quarter to quarter to, you know, kind of figure out what's going on in the world. And then I kind of go back in, you know, from a monitoring perspective, making sure that our managers are executing on the investment strategies that, you know, we agreed upon in committing capital to those managers.
This is why Dana's been a great partner for us for a very long time, because you want your LPs to think like other venture investors and long periods of time. And whenever I meet a potential new LP or somebody within one of our existing LPs and they're trying to time the market, that's always a sign for me there may not be a fit. Because if you think you can time the venture capital market, man, that is a tough thing.
So it's way more interesting for me to develop the relationships with the managers than not sleep at night because, you know, the market's really volatile and, you know, what is going to happen? I can't predict that. But what I can predict is in developing relationships with our managers, that's more important to me.
Yeah, I mean, I focus a lot with my team on, you know, what are the strategies that we have? How are we executing on those strategies? And then any data that we have that we're learning that would inform evolving those tactics and strategy. And the game of venture, I find, is really a very tactical, strategic discipline. And much like playing poker, which is why many of us are addicted to that game, because you have partial information and you're trying to unpack, you know, some strategies here and to make decisions with it, with that partial information, because you cannot control outcomes. You know, there are many crazy outcomes that I've seen. And if you told me your top three investments would be a cab company, a stock trading app that doesn't charge users for trading, and a meditation app, I would say, and a marketplace for, you know, handymen and or handy persons, whatever you call handymen today, I'd be like, what? But, you know, that's Uber, Thumbtack, Robinhood, and Calm. And you have to have some humility here to control the things you can control. And, you know, when I talk to my team, especially the young researchers that were turning into analysts and the analysts were turning into associates and associates were turning into principals, I say, how many meetings did you do? And how many check-in calls did you do with these founders? And what are they telling you? You know, and where are your notes? You know, that I can work with. But, you know, I can't magically have them, you know, create a follow-on investment for the portfolio. But we can set them up with meetings with investors and then talk to those investors and say, what did you think? And those investors will tell us, like, yeah, you know, I really love the company, but why is it growing so slow? Or why is their product velocity so bad? Or, you know, that founder is really interesting on a product basis, but where's the CFO and the, you know, chief technology officer and the director of sales? Like, they're doing everything. You know, what's going on with the management team, Jake? And so that's what you're trying to do, is really make sense of what you have in that portfolio. And what are the strategies you came up with? And what did you sell to the LPs? I'm constantly thinking about that. We said 50% of the fund's going to go into these 200 names. The next 50% of the fund's going to go into the top 5 to 10% of those. Okay, we're almost done with those 200 investments. And we are looking, did we actually find something great in here? If there's not something great in there, okay, well, we need to maybe call an audible here. Maybe we need to change the strategy for the second half of this fund. And I think that that's the name of the game now. I used to think it was just being a great picker because I got lucky, if I'm being honest, with hitting some, you know, half-court shots. I don't think you can make a career of half-court shots, all due respect to Steph Curry. What are you focused, Tom, in that sort of regard on strategies and tactics? Like, what is the strategy or tactic, and how does it how has it evolved recently? I'm curious.
Yeah, we've been, I would say, strategy-wise, pretty consistent over the past 23 years or so. And just to name it, the strategy is to invest in companies just as they hit product market fit. And that can be a variety of things. Like when we did Twitter and Snapchat, they were both pre-revenue. Typical software, the company though has some revenue and we're trying to and only invest in the things that can go public one day. That strategy hasn't really changed much, but some of the details, the tactics have. For instance, we opened a European office. We've got five people there now in London. We've done more secondaries over the years. It used to be 0%. Now it's, you know, probably 15, almost 20% of a given fund. And 20 years ago, 15 years ago, on average, I think we said, hey, a startup needs at least 10 million of revenue when we're investing. Now, of course, revenue models have changed. They're more predictable. There's no hard and fast rules for that. We're just looking for that like magical product market fit. So it's same strategy, sort of year in, year out, tactics have changed. Obviously, the other big thing is, as Dana knows, if you're going to be around like IVP has for 44 years, the team's also going to change and you need to go through generational transfer, which is some combination of tactics and strategy there too.
And I would have to say, like, best in class, like evaluating so many managers, that IVP does it right in terms of succession and how transparent they are with their investors, their LPs, and the plan for this is what's going to happen. It happens, and it happens consistently. I have to say, you know, kind of I'm struggling with a number of managers where there is no succession plan. They're well into, this is not like funds two or three. So I think, you know, succession plans are incredibly important, especially for long enduring, you know, kind of funds that we hope to invest with into the future.
How many years ahead of time would you want the succession plan to be communicated to as an LP?
Just depends on the cycle, where the manager is in their life's, you know, kind of life, where the leadership is. I think it just depends on the situation, whether it's a near-term exit or it's an exit that's going to happen in the following fund. You know, it just depends, I guess.
I was curious, Tom, when you were talking about the strategy and the tactics, one thing that has changed radically is the competitive nature of getting in at your Goldilocks zone. That, you know, product market fit, and definitely they're got the IPO possibility. Doesn't seem like you're the only fund that's going after that. Seems like there's a lot of funds now that maybe didn't even exist 20 years ago. How do you deal with competition and valuations, given that that's a Goldilocks zone that a number of people have identified, or just call it what it is, cribbed, copied from you?
Frankly, I think it's a natural thing and a good thing, because if the market were so small, there were two investors at this stage, we'd be swimming in a very small pond. But the interesting thing is, from like a day-to-day operating procedure for our firm, the market's not as big as it appears, mostly because people tend to specialize pretty quickly. You have a bunch of firms that ran some experiments and doing high volumes of, you know, pre-IPO type investments with no governance, you know, or and trying to add little value outside of the money. And that experiment kind of ran its course. You have folks who are very high touch. But if you're high touch and you're actually taking board seats, you can't make that many investments. It's just there's hours in a day and you can't scale your team infinitely. And so if you like zoom into the different strategies and different stages and you think about just the US and Europe and people who want to do B's and C's, but take board seats, and the senior people take board seats, they don't pass it off to a more junior person. And they're a reputable fund who's had, you know, been in a lot of IPOs and a lot of been associated with a lot of successful companies. That field starts narrowing. And then you say, okay, well, this happens to be an enterprise infrastructure company that does open source software. And we want to take on a board member who's done that before. Then all of a sudden, you're actually down to like relatively few competitors. So, you know, there's five, six firms that kind of end up in the same conversations. But that five or six will differ between a digital health company and an enterprise company and a consumer company. and based on where they're located and the exact parameters of the round. So I would say, Jason, like you asked me that question in January of 21, I give you a very different answer than I wouldn't have given in January of 2018 or today, which is like, yeah, the market's like, you know, pretty predictable. In 21, all bets were off and, you know, everything
was crazy. Venture came in and just took over the island and then they all went home after.
How did you avoid the temptation at IVP? You had your peers making hundreds of millions sometimes in management fees and you guys were sticking to your knitting. Did you ever get tempted to try to replicate the strategy?
Listen, we always have conversations about what's going on in the market. If you're not, that's kind of irresponsible in my point of view. But we've always had a dictum that our strategy dictates the fund size and fund size does not dictate strategy. And every single GP will repeat those exact words. And so for us, it's always like, okay, we're trying to lead rounds that are B's and C's and in the occasional D and even sometimes an A, but mostly B's and C's. How big are those rounds? If we want to write the lead check, how big is that lead check for the premium companies on average? And we want to write 30 or 40 of those checks per fund over 3 years, that tells you our fund size. The hard thing about 2021 is the round sizes got so big. As we were beginning to do the implied math, we were like, oh my God, our fund size would need to be 3 times as large as the most. And that kind of scared us because then we were like, but what if the market's changed? Well, fortunately, we were pretty disciplined in our pacing and deployed over 3 years that fund during that time. And by the time we actually went out to raise the fund, things had corrected, round sizes came down, and we're able to raise the same size, you know, fund as before. And so it kind of worked itself out. But I have to admit, like, there were some, you know, flying by the seat of the pants moments where we did wonder if we had to change our strategy and our fund size. Our gut told us no, but man, there were a lot of blog posts that said otherwise, like, hey, you know, venture's being disrupted, et cetera.
It's like that chocolate cake. Everyone knows you're not supposed to eat it, but not eating it is the hard part.
We also have this amazing governor on our strategy, which is called time, which Jason alluded to. It's just like, I can't be on 27 boards and we take board seats. That's like the fun part. That's the enjoyable part of the job. It's why I show up every day, is to work with founders. I'm not a stock picker. I can't do my job halfway as a board member. And that can only be sliced so many times. And so I think that temptation just kind of governed itself because of the hours in a day.
Okay, most of us in the startup game have heard of Brex. Not only have they perfected corporate cards for startups, they've also built the financial stack the founders can bank on. Nearly 40% of startups fail due to running out of cash. So to help founders, Brex has built a banking experience that takes every dollar further. It can help protect your cash and extend your startup's runway. How? By combining the best things about checking, treasury, and FDIC insurance into one powerhouse account. Brex's banking solution offers 20 times the standard FDIC protection through program banks, industry-leading yield on your cash, and the ability to send money worldwide at lightning speed. So, here's your call to action. Brex is used by 1 in every 3 U.S. startups. Amazing. Get the financial stack founders trust at brex.com/twist24. At brex.com/twist24.
Moving on. Cybersecurity is starting to play center stage in Silicon Valley. We saw last week Wiz's $23 billion acquisition offer from Google that the company rejected. And perhaps not as positively, CrowdStrike's outage that grounded many companies, including airlines, into a halt. Crunchbase is reporting that cybersecurity funding is up 144% in Q2 from the same quarter last year. Dana, thoughts on cybersecurity and how do you look at the space? Why is it suddenly heating up right now?
So the way I look at cyber, you know, as the one of the biggest categories of enterprise software, you know, what is it, 200, maybe 200 billion in TAM? And it's just growing, you know, double digits. And what is the investment opportunity around that? And I think that that is, you know, kind of thinking about the CrowdStrike. I mean, I was impacted. I had a blue screen for 4 days until I could get back into. So here's the interesting thing, because a lot of folks are working, you know, remotely. I could not get this fixed until I got back to my office, you know, in New Jersey, which, you know. And they were like, keep rebooting. And
they
eventually
figured out a way to get people to return to office, just turn their computers off at home. Now you have to come in. We're also turning off your electricity.
But, so. I think in terms of just the security, though, you know, kind of how AI is enabling, you know, kind of offense, you know, we have hackers and how, you know, companies are developing. I think it's a huge opportunity, and I think it's just going to get bigger. And it's going to be represented throughout my portfolio in a big way.
Tom, you guys are pretty busy in the cybersecurity space. Tell me about your view on the space right now, and why is it getting hot today?
I think all of this stems from platform shifts. When there's a platform shift, you need new types of security. We were investors in CrowdStrike. It's obviously a fantastic company. Testament to the fact that if you have a company that goes down and the world stops, you know they've kind of made a difference in the world or pushed a wave out. And that's true for CrowdStrike. For them, the innovation was using the cloud and the central intelligence of taking all the intel from endpoints, i.e. computers, bringing it to their central cloud, taking that data and using that knowledge to push out updates to the edge, which gives everybody better protection. That was their innovation. I think Wiz as well is kind of representative of one of those mega trends in security, which is the cloud operating model. All of a sudden, your servers aren't in a room somewhere. They're out there in AWS, et cetera. How do you protect those? And the side scanning technology that Wiz has was a really, you know, innovative development that makes it faster. AI is one of those platform shifts. How do you defend, in terms of like the inputs, the outputs for all these AI models? That's a brand new area. So I think that's driving some of that investment. You've got also a huge trend. I think maybe sleepily, one of the biggest trends is just the complexity of software development. So when you're building a new piece of software, it's not some monolith where like you can do a code review and the QA, you know, tests it and it's super easy. You've got like 3,000 microservices and the combinations of those things, it's so complicated. How do you make sure if one of those or two of those goes down, your service still works? And then you've got data, and you've seen a bunch of companies get funded. Our company Rubrik, which has data security at its core, you know, they were the first real software tech IPO in recent times. As all this data grows and becomes more important to AI and everything else, you've got to protect it somehow. And so you've got these changes in the importance of the components and the nature of the components getting more complex. What's happened is the surface area for attacks has just grown, you know, a multiple versus the days when everybody came into their desk and had one computer and it was on the network and there was one server and it was in the closet. Today's world is far more wild and woolly than that. And so you need more solutions.
Tom, you mentioned Rubrik had an IPO this year, one of the only ones to come out. You guys are, I'm sure, always talking to the Goldman Sachs, JP Morgans of the world. What's your view on the IPO window? And will we see any action in 2024 or 2025?
The IPO window, you have to kind of reference another window, which is the Overton window. It's kind of like, what's your definition of an open IPO window? Because if you think it was 2020, that ain't coming back. But if you think back to like post GFC, the great financial crisis, when, you know, what was that, 2011, 12, when you had like Facebook and Workday go out as like the big successful companies, what happened in the following years? It wasn't a rush to the exits. Like only really high quality companies went out for a number of years until maybe 2015, 2016, did you see a real uptick? And even then it wasn't a flood. So I think the bar is going to stay high. I mean, to go public, you probably want $300 million to $1 billion of revenue. You want to be near free cash flow positive. You got to be growing 25% plus probably to project the sort of 15 to 20% growth you need in the public markets. That's a high bar. I wish I could say all companies in our portfolio, you know, we're doing that consistently, but that's a high bar. There's just not many who are going to meet that.
Not to put words in your mouth, but are you telling your portfolio companies go public as a last resort, stay private until the market recovers? What's your guidance?
No, I mean, listen, everybody wants to go public. It's going public means you're, in general, your metrics, the health of the business is as good as it can be. It's just hard to do. And so if you have those sorts of performance metrics, you do it, which is, I think, you know, to Ossoff's credit at Wiz, like he looked around and realized, and I'm not an insider in the company, I've certainly met him, but he probably looked around and say, hey, we've got options on the table. Let's you know, let's go long. A lot of companies aren't going to have that option though. And so they're going to do their best. And ultimately, you know, kind of like the secondary market we were talking about earlier at the top of the show has become more liquid. The ability to sell a startup has also become more liquid because it's not just strategics, but you could sell to one of these PE firms, the Vistas and Thoma Bravos of the world that didn't exist. You know, you got a startup that's growing 10, 15%. As long as it's not burning cash, they could be buyers. And 15, 20 years ago, that entire ecosystem, that company would be worth essentially nothing because you couldn't go public. And if a strategic didn't want to buy you, you're in that company forever. Today, at least you've got some options.
Yeah. And imagine if M&A comes back with this regime change in Washington one way or the other. You know, we could see Lina Khan and this anti-M&A, anti-tech philosophy maybe wane to one of more dynamic markets. And, you know, the fact that PE has to come in and buy some of these companies means there's something broken in the M&A market, right? Because they are value by definition. They're looking for serious value, right? Whereas the public markets are just so optimistic, right? You're betting on the story and the future, whether, you know, it's Square or Blue Apron or it's Instacart or Uber, like, you know, these things can go in different directions. A more fluid marketplace would just be great for Americans and innovation and American exceptionalism globally. And I don't know why we are not letting Adobe or Wiz, like these are under $100 billion acquisitions, let them rip. Under a billion, not by the top three companies. Like,
yeah, that Roomba iRobot one with Amazon or whoever was like, what? Just,
I mean, it just Whole Foods. Like, did something terrible happen when Amazon bought Whole Foods? Nope. Whole Foods still great. No problem there. And you can get it delivered through your Amazon app. Great. Let's keep moving. Ring doorbell bought for $1 billion by Amazon. Did it end the world? Nope. Can you still buy other doorbells? Yep. No big deal. Dropcam, you know, now Nest, bought by Google, $1 billion. Did it end the world? Nope. Still buy, you know, cameras for $15 if you don't want the Nest ones for $150. Like, I think people don't understand in Washington or in Europe exactly how violent and brutal free markets are in today, in a global marketplace. You don't need to start putting your thumb on a scale. Like, this is already a gladiator's arena where, like, if you're not producing the best product, the market's going to stop you. People at Google right now are very scared of, you know, people doing searches on ChatGPT and Claude before they go to Google. Like, and that's the mighty Google with the biggest money printing machine humanity, I think, has ever made, you know, putting aside natural resources.
I don't know if you all saw Ben Thompson had a piece about CrowdStrike. Lina Khan made a comment that, you know, the power of a company like CrowdStrike is problematic and leads to these sorts of outages. But it was really the government's interference with Microsoft telling them that they couldn't close down their kernel access, basically, that sort of created the need for companies to do what they do versus what Microsoft was going to do in the first place. So, you know, but of course, that was a different regulatory regime and nobody's going to, you know, take the fall for that. So there's just a ton of unintended consequences, I think, when regulators get too involved here.
You know, just to add a cherry on top of this great icing you set up, Tom, like, it's almost like we have referees trying to be referees with Darwin. It's like, oh, there's a shark. It's going to eat a seal. And they're like, yeah, you know what? That seems unfair. And like, the shark just rips the seal in half. Like, that's the free market. You don't need to get involved. It's going to be fine. There's like price fixing. There are some tactical things that absolutely price dumping, price fixing, bundling. Sure. Let's give speeding tickets. Let's keep an eye on them. M&A, like the VCs and the capital allocators, the LPs who own these companies, they do a pretty good job of making sure that value is extracted. If they think this company should IPO, like the investors in Wiz seem to think, they're not going to sell. If they were going to sell, it's because somebody paid an extraordinary premium and or they don't have long-term faith in the business. What we saw this week when they walked away from $23 billion is that they have extremely, extremely high confidence in that management team and product set to continue to grow, to fill in that premium, or they're absolutely terrified and convinced that that is going to get stopped as an acquisition. So it's one of those two things drove that decision, or maybe a combination. I don't know if you've given it any thought, other panelists.
Does anyone know the breakup fee on that deal? Anyone know the rumored breakup fee?
I didn't see a breakup fee, no. Figma was a billion, I think, right?
Something. Yeah, $1 billion. I think that one of the things that regulators don't think about in M&A is it's a marketplace. So you have the tech companies buying companies, but you also have a very important other player, which is the startup. And the startup ecosystem, which is funded by venture capitalists. And regardless of what you think of personally, you might like or dislike venture capitalists, it is the engine of the American economy. Almost the totality of GDP growth or incremental GDP growth in the US. You look at the Magnificent Seven, I believe all seven of them were venture backed. So it's really important for regulators to think of it as an ecosystem. What happens if you turn off the faucet? What are the downstream repercussions to that? Because that will end up hurting not just Google, not just Microsoft, not just Facebook, which, you know, people may like or dislike, but it'll hurt the next startup and the next founder and the next employee. And that could have really poor long-term consequences on the ecosystem and on the entire US economy, on GDP, and even down to the taxable income of the country and Social Security and Medicare. So there's a lot of repercussions to trying to hurt, you know, the large tech companies that may or may not be intended.
Yeah, it feels like it became political when it should, like when the FTC, et cetera, get involved, should be purely a business decision based on market share and, you know, perceived surplus or detriment to the consumer. Tech companies are in the headlines. So, you know, the UK will undo the Giphy Facebook acquisition, but some boring, you know, PE-backed ball bearings company does a roll-up and gets huge market share, and that's not in the headlines, and the regulators aren't going after those more boring businesses. So I think part of this is just like, you know, being in the spotlight as the for the technology industry has some downsides to it, but I wish this were less political.
Next on to our lightning rounds, where our guests go through their latest three investments. Tom?
Good timing on this. I've got a security company that'll be announcing a new investment that'll be announcing this week, probably tomorrow. So I can't talk about that one right now, but it's really exciting. Happy to come back in a future day and talk about that one.
You got
to
give us some headline.
I would say it has to do with the complexity of developing software today. It's a company we've been tracking for a long time, really awesome set of founders, and is growing like gangbusters. So we're really excited about that one. And by the way, at IVP, there's no like, we don't take individual ownership for any given deal. There's at least two GPs on every single investment as sponsors, but it's really the whole partnership behind every deal. So it's always an awkward question, but I'll take some ownership for these. Cortex is a company that is a recent IVP investment. Think of it like a portal or a catalog that helps give developers a reference on all the services and pieces of software that exist within a software stack of a tech company. So that you're not going in and trying to basically figure it out for yourself every time, and is a sort of a rich database of information on everything running within a company's software stack. Cribble is another one. Cribble is basically a platform for data or log management. IVP invested in. It's a company that's at scale right now. We invested a few years ago, and think of it as sort of the next generation of log management, like a Splunk. Other systems like that. And they help save companies a ton of money and give them more control, granular control over how they route that data and ultimately what they do with it. Really boring stuff. I love this sort of stuff that's deep within the stack of of the infrastructure of big enterprises.
Absolutely amazing. I will share some fun stuff we're doing. Okay, so this is a fun one. So you know, we have an accelerator called the Launch Accelerator, very similar to Techstars, Y Combinator. We've done 32 classes. We've had a number of companies become worth over 100 million. We had a unicorn come out of it, and we're on a 32nd class. And before that, we have something even more fun called Founder University, which is year zero, people building projects. So we now have year zero and year one. So we kind of get in ahead of Y Combinator and Techstars with this Founder University product, where 200 teams come together to build a product. Half of them aren't even incorporated. One of those companies was Chef's Reactions, somebody who I met online, and I was watching Mr. Beast and some of these other performers create really large businesses. And he reacts to videos on TikTok. Have you any of you ever seen him in these hilarious videos?
Yeah.
You have? Great.
Yeah.
So he's absolutely extraordinary.
Well, because my son
he has 3.6 million followers now. He gets regularly, you know, 250,000 to 1 million people view each one. And he was working at like a golf club or resort in Canada, making a, you know, a chef's salary, basically. And in our founder university, we'll give people $25K for 2.5% if they start the company. We become the first investor, $1 million valuation. Done 80 of those investments so far. People in the industry think we're crazy. And now they're starting to become real businesses. This one, when we gave them the 25K, went from being a, you know, maybe $15,000 a year to $30,000 a year, like little ad business, immediately to $300,000 in advertising revenue and some merchandise. And we said to him, hey, would you come to the accelerator and let's take the next step. Let's build a repeatable business with product, services, et cetera. We're not going to announce the product or service here now. But distribution is the hardest thing that founders can do. Now, imagine you have distribution and a loyal audience and all they need is a product with your name on it. That's what we think, you know, these top influencers represent. And so we're doing two experiments. I can't talk about the other one yet, where we're making small bets on them, then a second bet, and then eventually a third bet. So now Chef Reactions is in our accelerator and we have a really exciting business that he'll be debuting shortly. LayerPath allows people to really quickly create product demos. Product demos, super important, whether you are a startup or a big company, like taking people through your product in order to adopt it, super important. Whether you're like walking people through how to use a drone or how to use your car VCR, what, you know, historical, or it could be an app. And so they make this tool that is incredibly fast and lets you manage. So imagine Figma or another content creation tool like that, Adobe Premiere, Photoshop, but just for this one use case. And just think about how amazing those product demos can be. Product demos are so arduous to build that a lot of people skip them. And those are some of the things that make products the most sticky. So we're very excited about that one. Mastertech.ai, yet another AI company, verticalized. They are creating a companion, like a co-pilot, for mechanics. Now you're like, well, mechanics, like, you know, what do they know about AI and computers? They don't need to know anything. If they put on a pair of glasses or they go to their computer or laptop, which they have in every bay now, and you tell it what you're doing, whether through voice or by wearing a pair of AR glasses or taking a picture of something, they now can get you in touch with the latest reports. And there are these reports created by every car manufacturer, and they change all the time. Toyota will put a new one out for a carburetor, whatever it is. So now imagine using AI to make mechanics make less mistakes and to get that car out of the bay and into the parking lot ready for the customer faster. We think there's massive leverage here. And if you can make a mechanic but 5% faster and reduce errors by 5%, this could be a money printing machine. And we just love these kind of boring businesses and we're getting really good at finding them. Ridiculous, TAM. You know, when I asked them the number of mechanics, I think is low millions and the number of bays. We do a top, what we call a bottom-up TAM every time we invest in a company and we train our researchers to do that. And actually, I was really surprised because I was like, tell me the number of people. They're like, oh, the number of mechanics isn't what's important. I'm like, okay, educate me. They're like, number of bays. And my team figured out the number of bays there were because that actually is the throttling, is how many bays you can get active at once. And then one mechanic might be working three bays at a time because they're waiting for a part and they don't want to take the thing down. You get the idea. So super excited about these three. And I just want to say, like, the entrepreneurial activity because of AI, Tom, I'm sure you're experiencing this, man, it has reinvigorated entrepreneurs where they are looking at every single problem in the world and saying, AI first, what does it look like? Just like they did with mobile, just like they did with cloud, just like they did with the internet, broadband, dial-up, CD-ROMs, media before that, PCs before that, client server before that. Just and this one feels to me like the one that takes all previous platform changes and just, I don't know, 10x is it? Like the leverage these companies are getting to, I don't know if you're seeing this in your portfolio, Tom, like the number, the revenue per employee or the number of employees to get to 1 million, the number of employees to get to 10 million, it's staying static. It's like a static headcount is a thread or a theme I've been really focused on. Uber stays the same size, but grows revenue in the high teens or low 20s every year. What's happening? Wait a second. Like, this is a really big, big story that is not being reported anywhere.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing that within the portfolio. Like a bunch of companies do RIFs, take out 20% of the headcount, and they're like, oh, our sales are going to go down 20% or 10%. And they're like, it went up 3% this quarter. Like, how did that happen?
It's dead weight.
Yeah. And just people underestimate the bigger you get, the more complex organizations get, the less gets done.
Yep. 100%. I mean, you essentialism, you know, just like this, what is essential in running a business is a question being asked right now. And I think in a world of unlimited capital and some money printing machines, the wrong lessons were taught to two generations, Gen Xers and millennials, which was just hire ahead of growth. Just keep hiring. Just get that talent off the market. Get them into a cube. We'll figure out what to do with them later. Wrong. Bad idea. Total distraction. This is why I hate internships, because the 10 weeks of an intern, by the time they do
a big investment,
whenever they do something meaningful, they're like, bye. I'm going to, thanks for putting me on your resume. I'm now going to go work at IVP and bring them all your secrets, Jake Allen. I'm like, thanks. I only do internships for LPs and their kids.
I was going to say, I love my interns.
I mean, don't get me wrong, it's
actually
rewarding.
I'm trying to like train them up to go into private equity. You know, I'm like, skip the institutional allocator job. Go straight to private equity.
You just want a network of spies out there, Dana, who can report back to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Exactly. There it is.
Exactly.
She's planting them everywhere. Sleeper cells inside of BlackRock and other books.
Right,
I love it.
Right.
And Dana, I want to put you on the spot. Oh, yeah. You have a $100 million minimum check size. How do you invest in venture funds?
Yeah. So we were talking about this VC earlier. Yeah. I just wanted to say, like, I 100%, you know, I want innovation in our portfolio. I think we have like 800,000 retirees. I think to have an alternatives portfolio where you have, you know, different return profile, you know, kind of investing in different assets, but private equity, it's the growth engine of our $90 billion, you know, portfolio. And a big key to that is having venture in the program. And how do I do that when I'm writing $100 million checks? I write $100 million checks because I have great partners like IVP that can take $100 million. We think very carefully around what is an LP base of a manager. And we never want to be more than 10 to 15% of a fund because you want a very balanced LP base. And what happens if a CIO comes in and hates venture and you never get to invest in venture again? That happens. Where there's just different priorities about how allocation policy should be developed. I fortunately work for an institution where, you know, our allocation policy is very generous to the alternatives. And, you know, we're targeting 13% for private equity. And that ranges. I would say, like, you see other large institutional investors, it's 16%. In endowments, it's much, much more, right? It's, you know, kind of north of 20% or 30% is, you know, kind of their portfolio is dedicated to venture. So 13%, I'm underallocated. I'm at 12. I'm one of the few, you know, allocators out there.
So you have a couple more $100 million checks.
That actually has some ready capital to deploy. I mentioned where it's a global portfolio and I'm investing in buyout growth and venture. And we have a lot of partners that help us get allocated dollars to. We're investing in emerging managers. I'm investing in emerging venture managers. I'm investing in emerging growth and buyout managers. And then I'm also investing, I have an SMA for mature seed Series A funds. That's where I'm kind of like skewing to seed Series A in this SMA, where the check sizes can be from, you know, 10 million to 35 million. And these portfolios are meant to be built and, you know, we'll keep allocating it's 300, 200 million, 250. And then we'll, you know, kind of we'll fill it up with allocations. We'll close it and then we'll start a new one. And so, you know, you have these vehicles where you can kind of keep re-upping into the managers in separate. So you have vintage year diversification, you have manager diversification, you have generalists, you have sector focus, you know, it's the whole, you know, nine yards, primarily North America, you know, for the venture programs. But yeah, that's how I'm building my venture program, where I have my core, you know, the key primary where I'm investing 100 to 150. I'll have the SMAs where I can do my smaller checks for the emerging and then for the mature kind of early seed series A. And then eventually I'll probably do some sort of secondary to kind of, you know, as I said earlier, kind of cover those vintage years where we did not have, you know, exposure. So we're really busy over here. It's been a year. I probably allocate between $1.5 billion and $1.9 billion. That's my target annually. So far this year, we're probably at about $1.3 billion in terms of what's been committed. And there's stuff that was just approved today. This has been a really busy day. We had our State Investment Council meeting. And I am, you know, very consistently building a program that, you know, kind of will into the, you know, kind of, I'm thinking, again, for the next 10 years, what will this program look like? And each year, I know what managers are going to be going into it. I'm constantly on the hunt for new managers.
Don't forget seed and Series A.
No. Seed and Series A is a huge part of the SMA. Mm-hmm. Well, both for the emerging and for the, I mean,
no, it's a challenge because we decided we're going to do $50 million funds. Back, Tom, to your thing that, you know, strategy equals fund size, I think you said, or strategy dictates fund size, not fund size dictates strategy. I could raise larger funds, but when you're trying to do something, you know, that's an accelerator, pre-accelerator, and then just follow on to the top winners, you don't need 150 or 250 million. You need 50 or 75 is the right number, right? And then everything else becomes attraction, which means we have a lot of people who love us, but they're like, oh, we have this thing, 25 is the minimum, and we can't be more than 10%. So you have these, you know, formulas that are, you know, codified, and they make sense. I understand why they're codified, but then they just preclude a relationship from occurring. And I'm like, make an exception, do 5K, do 5 million or do 10 million. They're like, yeah, I go to a group, I got to get them to approve that exception. But I do see people now starting to think about it. So I think it's a creative solution you come up with. Yeah. Like, how do we engage those managers?
And it's not a fund to funds. I mean, this is managed account specifically from New Jersey. But the key to it is that there are five other managed accounts by large institutional allocators. So they're, you know, kind of our, you know, partner goes out, they get an allocation, they come back, split it across. You don't even have to, I don't even have to go into all of the, you know, allocations that they bring to us, but there's a whole allocation policy. And it's just what I'm focused on is building a flywheel and also back to relationships, because some of these managers may grow, or I may make that exception and do 25 million versus 100 million. But it's all about getting to know the manager, right? And developing the relationship. And having the conviction around that this is going to be, especially if it's seed or series A, this is going to be a 10X fund.
Which is, you know, what seed is in a unique position to do. Yeah. Great job, David. Congratulations on 20 episodes.
Thank
Here
you.
We are.
Yeah. 20
Congratulations.
Episodes.
Wow.
Nice. Yeah.
Thank
I mean,
you.
I just wanted to do a niche podcast because I couldn't find anybody talking about these things with people like us. And it's like, this is like a wonky podcast that we all enjoy.
It's very difficult. We're very, very, very honored and very privileged to have somebody like Dana from pension funds because it's not easy to get pension funds on guests.
Oh, really? I'm sorry. Well, I'm sorry on behalf of my peers, but
no,
I think that it's
more their compliance.
I feel like part of my job too is to educate, you know, kind of our broader audience on what we do, why we do it, and, you know, and how we do it.
Well, another great episode. We've made it to episode 20 for Dana Johns, Tom Lavaro, Jason Calacanis. This is your host, David Weisbert. Thanks for listening.